kids are the only ones in the
Okay, I think we're plugged in. Whoops, don't have a pocket.
Yeah, so I'm going to do Oedipus Rex. Now, my experience with Oedipus Rex is we were shown, I think we were mentioned in high school, and then in college, we were shown a film of it. And I'm sure there's film versions over in the library if you want to get one. But they all are really awful. All right?
Mind-boggling bad. So these giant people come out in masks trying to recreate the drama of the Greek amphitheater circa 460 BC. Oh, Oedipus! Oh, the horror! Laios, where is he? I do not know, you know. So I'm going to avoid that. And so I knew of a film of Oedipus, because I got this working, I'm going to backtrack and just let's retrace. I'm going to go back to Joseph, and I'm going to show you another clip of something on the Bible. Actually, they're both on the Bible, aren't they? And the point is interpretation, that these texts are there and they're constantly reinterpreted. And Oedipus is going to be different. It really talks to us. I guess it is. Freud did a pretty good interpretation on it. But let's just take a look at this. It's kind of fun. And I want to do this. There's a warning that this is coming to Purdue, and maybe we'll go see it. This was originally written for an English school. No, don't tell me there's no sound there. Okay. I'll play about 10 minutes of it. What the interpretation of the story is. Right?
Now I don't say who is wrong, who is right, but if by chance you are here for the night, then all I need is an hour or two to tell the tale of a dreamer like you. We all dream a lot. And it could.
Joseph's mother, she was quite my favorite wife. I never really loved another all my life. Joseph was my joy because he reminded me of her.
Through young Joseph, Jacob blessed his youth again, loved him, praised him, gave him all he could, but then it made the rest feel second best. And even if they were
being told we're all so grand, does not make us Joseph fans.
But where they have really missed the boat,
been great guys, but no one seems to notice.
Joseph's charm and winning smiles failed to slay them in the aisles, and their father couldn't see the danger.
Of this story. What's one of the things that you think about? How about the opening song with a little school teacher telling all the school kids they can dream?
Dreams can come true.
Yeah, it's a happy thing, your dreams can come true. Sort of the all-American story. I'm not sure that's... I hadn't thought of that. That's a biblical story, which is, really about how the Hebrew race got down into Egypt. That's not bad. You got to kind of hand it to it. It's cute. How about that coat? What did that represent? Well, and I was telling you about how it sort of made him into a cowboy. It's actually country western stuff coming up. It sort of represented the dream, right? The dreamer, as opposed to his brothers, who don't really dream, I guess, or want to keep him down while he dreams. The problem is he's so oblivious to what he's doing to them, and his favoritism. But that's just part of the story. So the coat is this dream, and then it turned into this dream of why were all those sheep different colors and all those children dancing around? What's the dream? Suddenly it's a very American 1960s, 70s dream of diversity. Everybody's different and we can all have one happy family, which is, I gotta tell you, not what this story is about. Okay. But it's like, it's still a reading, and you can go with it, right? And I find it really cute. It certainly brings out the creativity of the story and its adaptability to different situations, which is the whole point of those Old Testament stories. They would, if they were written for a desert people tending sheep, they had a remarkable shelf life and still appeal to people today who see different things in them. So, are you following my point about interpretation? Okay. So, anything else in there? It seems weird. And we ended with that, the dream that one of the ones that's actually in the text, the dream of Joseph's dream of the 12 sheaves of grain bowing down to him, right? Which I suggest is fairly obvious. And at that point, I think the drama of the situation is brought out very well by this, because Joseph is like happily giddily oblivious to the effect on his brothers. So if nothing else, I mean, I like it because it's such a clear, easy to follow interpretation. Right? Do you agree? It's not. All right, so the next one I have here is a tape, a DVD I dug up of it's based on another biblical interpretation. Right? And it's from a 1961 British review. It was called Beyond the Fringe, and it starred Dudley Moore. Do you remember Dudley Moore? He used to show up in movies. He got this horrible disease. And these guys all became really famous. It was a London show. It came to New York, and I happened to see it when I was 12, in New York. And it was, even for a 12-year-old kid who didn't know anything about the world, it was riotously funny. Now, you're going to watch a kind of black and white tape of it, and so we're not in the theaters, and film is a colder medium, but I think you'll get the point of this skit, which is an English preacher who is taking a biblical text and reading into it, just what Andrew Lloyd Webber was doing, right? But this guy's a fool, and he takes a text, and he gets absolutely nothing out of it. He can't figure out what it's about, right? The text is, my brother Esau is an airy man, but I am smooth, which is a line from the Jacob and Esau story, which is clearly about paternal strife, just as this was, but this drifts off into the all-American dream of racial diversity, and this guy is up here trying to figure out what this passage is about. And I hope the reaction is somewhat similar to when I played the song of Deborah for you, with all those words and ones Olivier going, and then the son of Abimelech slew the gads of, you know, poor. What does all that mean? Let's see if we can get this to work. This is a little harder because I have to go to the right thing. Why isn't it showing up? I have yet to go to the morning. I can't get to the top. I was going to get this to work today, okay?
Challenge to each and every one of us here. 28th Aunt Kevin. The other evening, I was very uncomfortable that he said this, when my eye was caught by a rather personable young lady who was sitting there on a bench. And as I walked by, she called out to me, and she said, "Hey, Padre, have you got the tie?" Anxious to chat, so I sat down beside her on the bench. In the course of conversation, I laid my hand upon her knee. And suddenly she said, "Hey, Padre, what's the little game?" "Hey, Padre." "What's the little game?" I was very grateful to that young lady, because, you see, she put me in mind of the kind of question I thought I ought to be asking you here tonight. What's the little game? What is this whole vivid, exciting little game that we call life about? Very many years ago, I went mountain climbing in Scotland with a very dear friend of mine. It was this mountain, you see. We decided to climb it. So, very early one morning, we arose and we began to climb. All day we climbed. Up and up and up. Higher and higher and higher. Till the valley lay very small below us. The mist of the evening began to come down, the sun to set. When we reached the summit, we sat down to watch this tremendous sight of the sun going down behind the mountain. And as we watched, my friend, very suddenly and violently, vomited. Some of us think life's a bit like this. It isn't, you know. Life, well, it's rather like opening a tin of sardines. We're all of us looking for the key. Some of us think we found the key, don't we? Oh, we think we found the key. We roll back the lid of the sardine tin of life. We reveal the sardines, the riches of life they're in. We get them out, we enjoy them. You know, there's always a little bit in the corner that you can't get out. I wonder, is there a little bit in the corner of your life? I know there is in mine. Prepare to go out into the world. I want you, in times of trouble and sorrow and hopelessness and despair, amid the hurly-burly of modern life, if ever you're tempted to say, "Oh, stuff this for a lark," I want you then to remember, for comfort, the words of my first text to you tonight. "But my brother Ezo is a hairy man, but I am a smooth man."
You didn't have to be sort of short answer there. I want you guys running off and posting stuff. Oedipus Rex is a play, yes, true. You know? So let's take a look at it. This is, the author is Sophocles. We're on page 612. Oh boy. That's kind of a tough act to follow that one. A little worried here. Okay, the story of this play takes place in the Greek city of Thebes.
Right.
Because, you know, the basic facts are right to keep in mind, right? But it's written, the play is written in a play for the people of Athens, right? So Athens is not Thebes. Athens is the, you know, our favorite Greek city, the home of democracy and things like that. Or even though it was a slave city and women didn't vote, there's really 500 citizens, but among those 500 citizens, they set up the foundations of democracy, and through one reason or another, became a kind of the role model for the American founders, who were all trained in the classics, and were back to the Roman Republic and the Athenian democracy as models, even though to be frank, these models were not perfect. In that city, the Athenians, following the defeat of the Persians in this golden age of 50 years from 430 to 480 AD, were quite full of civic pride, and one of the ways that manifests itself is they knew that they had problems, but in the art they would project. This is kind of latest scholarly theory that the Athenians would project problems that were probably affecting their own society on other cities.
Okay.
So it's those Thebans who are so bad, who make such horrible mistakes. But clearly, it affects the audience sitting there in Athens too. All right, they don't. In other words, Oedipus is. It's so interesting because he's a man just like any Athenian, even though he lives in Thebes. But this gets rid of the political problem of being accused of being anti-Athenian. Right? Anti-American. And if you don't think other countries have that kind of thing, you've got it all wrong. That's why Socrates was put to death, right? Because he was corrupting the youth of Athens, right? And not supporting the Athenian way of life. So we have a bigger view, which, by the way, is the theme of the Antigone on Thursday, which is a story about, really quickly, another play by Socrates, but it's the classic story, as I'll be saying, of individual conscience versus public prescriptive behavior. What do you do when you live in a society where the laws are dead wrong, and you know it? Antigone is the young lady, daughter of Oedipus, actually, who goes up against her city's laws and, of course, dies for it. That's the answer. But it's still the great play of conscience, right? It would be much more affecting for you, as it used to be for us, if you were being drafted into an officer. So you can think about this in the abstract, right? Now let's go back to Oedipus. This is really a play about, like I said before, a plot and what I might call action as a definition of character. What a character's thought is really crucial in the play. And the story is Oedipus. Oh boy, putting this. Oedipus is the son of King Laius of Thebes and his wife Jocasta. But when the baby was born, they heard an oracle that said this baby is going to kill its father and sleep with its mother. Right? So they take the baby and they put it out on the hillside of Mount Cithaeron. I don't know what that is. Which is a mountain near Thebes. To expose it so that it'll die. Exposing babies was actually a fairly common practice. Right? You had a baby you didn't want and just put it out there to die. You read about this in the paper all the time. Generally girl babies were disposed of, but in this case it was a boy baby. Right? What happened though is the I hope I'm not giving a bit of the shepherd who the guy who was charged with taking the baby and putting it on Mount Cithaeron had sympathy for him, right? And so let's call him, this is the hard part, shepherd number one, had sympathy for the baby and gave him to another shepherd, even though the baby had pierced ankles, and that's what the name Oedipus comes from. And this shepherd took the baby and brought it over to the town of Corinth. Where there was a king named Polybus and his wife Merope, who needed a baby. They were looking to adopt. So they were quite happy to take in Oedipus, who grew up thinking he was the son of Polybus and Merope. They didn't tell him he was adopted. One day when he grows up, this is a lot, huh? They're thinking this stuff up, it's pretty good. Right? One day when he was, this is not the order in which the bits come into play. One day when he was growing up, a drunken man at a banquet said to him, you know what, you're not really their son. So the secret was sort of known and let slip. Well, this just destroyed Oedipus. He seemed to have a very keen desire to know who he was, or who he is, in the play, which we all have, universal. Right? And that's why this play is so grabbing. Although most of us in this sort of messy situation. Still sort of want to know who you are. Right? You know, now we have some genetic ways of finding out. Okay. So Oedipus is so freaked out, he wants to find out whose son he really is. Or he wants to find out if this is true. Right? That's actually two questions, isn't it? Who is he and is this lie true? And Oedipus has got a little problem like most of them. He never quite separates out the issues fully. He's always a little blind to the implications, like most of us. You know, sometimes it's better just not to look into things. All right? Maybe you're the type that likes social. Well, he goes to the oracle of Apollo, who's sort of the ruling god in this play, and he's got an oracle. You know what an oracle is? Anybody from Delphi? You know, Delphi's a little town just up here in the... You from Delphi? You ever Logan for it? Okay, so the Delphi, their team is the Delphi Oracle, right? Because Apollo had an oracle at Delphos. Otherwise, I guess you know this Delphi. Quibble over the endings, all right? An oracle is a woman who sits there chanting answers to the questions, you know, surrounded in smoke, and allegedly God is feeding her these answers. In real life, these things are schemes, you know, by a bunch of guys, you know, making money, the charge for this, but that's not in the play at all right? And they might have believed what they were doing, okay? But the Delphi, he goes to Delphi to the oracle, who tells him that, he's going to kill his father and sleep with his mother. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? This is what, right? That's what his parents were told. That's why they exposed him. Then he gets the same message. message is repeated. It's a slant of pattern of repetition. So he kind of forgets about the issue of who he is, which is actually a huge mistake. All right. And he runs away from home so that he won't kill the people he thinks are his parents, Polybus and Merope. He leaves Corinth. But you see, he sort of forgot the issue he went to Delphi for in the first place, right, which was to find out if he was their children. He then assumes he is. Right, so he makes a natural assumption that the real issue is don't kill your parents. Right, that was the kind of thing we would all do, but that's why it's a tragedy. Because this is a play about the stuff we all do and the absolute hell that comes as a result of it. We all make these. I want you to think about the tragic situation, you know, the thing he did is really sorry for. Right? I don't know if we have time to go into that, but it's interesting. So he runs away from Corinth. And as he's trekking over trekking around Greece, actually aiming towards Thebes, he comes to a crossroad. And I should know the name of the Phocis. It's the town called Phocis. And there at the crossroads, he meets some real jerk who's got outrunners and a chariot, and they have a confrontation, and Oedipus is nobody's fool, right? And when this guy runs him off the road and then says something nasty to him, Oedipus kills him and everybody with him. Because, you know, Oedipus is a one tough guy. Right? We admire that, don't we? This is the thing about tragic heroes. We really admire his toughness. We admire his curiosity. But who do you think that guy was he killed at the crossroads? It's his father, Elias. So he has now killed his father, but he doesn't know it. Somehow he wants, and this all makes not a lot of sense, but Aristotle says, well, you know, it's not impossible. It's improbable, but it's not impossible, and that's what makes a good story. Okay. He sort of gets into Thebes, and you would think there would be an uproar. This is a beautiful part about the story. It'd be an incredible uproar that their king has been killed on a crossroads, and everybody, and they've got to find the murderer. We need justice. But they're all consumed with something else. So the issue of life and death is being shunted off to the side. It's like, you know, not worrying about forming social security because you're doing something else. Right? And the thing that they're all worried about is the Sphinx. There's this monster like a hawk who's coming down and scooping people away, doing something. We never get a good look at the Sphinx. Right? But it sounds like, if you wanted to put it in real terms, take it out of the myth, it sounds like it's like some other power, it's another state that's demanding slaves. So send me three of your best-looking daughters on Wednesday. Oh God, here we go again. And now I want three sons for my navy. Oh God, I've got to send the tribute. Somebody's exacting tribute. That's sort of the way the translation brings out the Sphinx. But in real life, it's just a monster who's plaguing the city and killing people, and nobody can get rid of this Sphinx. Now, what's so interesting about this story is normally you would just hire the fastest gun in the West, right? Take a sword, you go, and have a battle with this bird monster perched up on this cliff, the face of a woman, eagle's wings, bear claws, lion, this combination. And you would just kill it. But you can't. The only way to defeat the Sphinx is to outsmart it, because the Sphinx's power is based on a riddle. You have to be able to answer the riddle. Okay? And it's a riddle in a footnote in your text, but here it is. You know the riddle? The Sphinx says, what goes on four legs in the morning, two legs at noon, and three legs in the evening? Now, what's the key to the riddle? Interpretation. And you want to push it a little further while you're at it. You have to realize that you're not actually talking. Remember that, like, the sleep in Gilgamesh wasn't really sleep? It was death? Well, here, the day, morning, noon, and night, isn't really a day. What is it? Yeah, it's the course of a person's lifetime. All right, so in the morning of your life, as Frank Sinatra might put it, you go on four legs because you crawl. In the noon of your life, which is the middle of your life, you walk on two legs. But when you get old, then you need a cane. In the evening of your life, so to speak, but evening is just a metaphor for this old age, you walk on three legs. And Oedipus solves the problem. Okay? And that eliminates the threat of the Sphinx, and everybody's sort of forgotten about the murdered king. But, of course, a murdered king leaves a widowed queen. And Oedipus is now everybody's favorite presidential candidate because he's done something wonderful. And in those days, he didn't run for president. You married into the royal family, and since here's a nice widow waiting, Oedipus married Jocasta, who is, of course, who? His mother. Right? So he just married his mother. He doesn't know it. The play doesn't raise the age issue, but I can assure you when there's enough money at stake, it doesn't matter. Okay, and we can figure her for 32 years old. She has Oedipus when she's 12 or 13. She's probably still pretty good looking, right? Maybe that works. He's 20 at this point. Maybe, you know, the dates aren't in there, but you can work it out. It's not it's highly improbable, but it's not impossible. Okay? That's essentially where we are when this play starts. But Oedipus doesn't know who he is. He doesn't know he's killed his father. He doesn't know he's married to his mother. And the play is about his discovering that and what he does in the aftermath. And basically, just so the plot of what we actually read is Oedipus getting it into his head to find out who he is. And then discovering who he was, and at the end, put his eyes out, punishment for himself for his crime. And I think the first thing you realize is, well, what was his crime? I mean, why should he punish himself? I mean, he didn't know it was his father. He didn't know that was his mother. But it may not matter to you, and this is the only answer to that, it may not matter to you, but it seems to matter a great deal to Oedipus, okay? Because he actually went through it. Okay. Oh, it's okay, it's great. You know, we don't care about it. Well, life doesn't work, it's still got the trauma, even though, right, you know that it's not your fault. It sounds like that Oedipus isn't actually doing anything. And I said that this has got to be a play about, this is different from really the Aeschylus play, because Oedipus does stuff. And what do I mean by doing stuff? It's having a choice. And I guess he has a choice to kill Laius, but we're not there at that instant. And he has a choice to marry. It's not really presented as a choice. You know, a jerk gets in your way, you kill him. Widow woman, you know, the kingdom, you marry her. He wasn't really thinking about that. Okay. So the choice, and this is really the big thing you have to remember, the thing I want you to remember, and I may be wrong, feel free to argue, but I don't think I am, is that Oedipus's choice here, the thing that does him in, is his blind pursuit of the truth of who he, the situation of who he is. He chooses to be the detective investigating, even when
everything is saying, don't, particularly Jocasta, don't keep looking, stop. No, I'm Oedipus, I'm tough, I'm full of pride. Nothing stops me from pursuing the truth. And that's the choice he makes that does the myth. And that we admire. Now when you go to, when you're in high school, if you did any of this stuff, the teacher says to you, a tragedy is about a person with a tragic flaw, some awful mistake, some weirdness in their disposition that creates trouble. And I think that's just wrong. That's just like, I'm sorry, you're so weird and you got into trouble. You know? I mean, I can't really respond to that. Okay, you're a jerk, and then you kind of deserved it. It's when your best quality gets you into trouble. The thing you are, your strength. Okay, Oedipus is this force of personality that we all kind of admire and wish we had. And the fact that if he had to do it again, he would do it again. Because he's certain he's right. Even when the situation is uncomfortable, he has to do what's right, and all hell breaks loose because guess what? It wasn't such a good idea. Okay. That's why I punish you. I think we can feel free now. We have an open debate. I mentioned this in class a couple of years ago. I mean, you can look at Iraq in the same situation. If you think President Bush was doing the right thing and would do it again, as a good man driven by careful, judicious weighing of the situation, you have to realize that this is a horrible tragedy in the philosophically sense. If you think he was a jerk and he was purposely hiding the truth, and he just wasn't paying attention, and then there's nothing tragic about it. It's just a horrible mess. And that distinction between a tragedy and a horrible mess, right, turns on what I'm calling the action of the character, okay, which is a kind of moral choice. By moral choice, I mean a conscious weighing of alternatives and coming up for good reasons because of the goodness of your nature with a course of action. Right? That's what you would do again. You're doing what you think is right. That's what makes it interesting. And then the tragedy is like, guess what? There's a lot of stuff you did not know. And it wasn't your fault. That's what affects us, and that's that particularly tragic reaction. You get it? Where we go, oh my God, I've been showing up to class every day, I'm doing the right thing. It's like freaky! That's tragic. Right? Where, I'm going off, I never show up, and I know what's going on, it's just a bum. Right? You don't get too excited about it. Right? So we have this. That board is getting that this tragedy, all right? So, let's take a look at the flag now. I'm going to walk you through a bunch of it. But you should certainly know who Oedipus is by this time, right? If you're here, you know the play takes place in Thebes. The play starts really just like Homer, very dramatic. Okay. There's what triggers it, there's a plague on the city. And people want Oedipus to get rid of it. Right? He has to do something. He has to do something. And people are dying. And they don't know why. And Oedipus comes out and he says, what's the matter out here? And they all go, well, we're dying, why don't you do something? And you would think, he goes, the normal friend goes, oh, I guess I should do something. You see, but this is all a setup. Oedipus has already done something. Just like Achilles and Caucasus sort of thing. He comes out and says, something wrong here?
They go, yes, we're all dying.
Oh, you common people. Oh, that's horrible.
But guess what?
I've already sent to the Oracle. Creon will be back any minute now to tell us exactly what's wrong, because, see, I have your best interest in mind. I'm so clever. Okay. And he's almost a little too clever for his own good, but he's done the right thing. And then actually, if you think about the play in my production of it, remember he's got these skinny legs, because his ankles are piercing as a child. But he should come out almost like a kind of cap, you know, in the paper, looking at something wrong here. So that's, you know, it's weird. Yeah. Nobody really knows. I have no idea. I guess it was a great way to carry the kid. Okay. I mean, there's etymologies running through this book. In the footnotes and you know, there's theories that his destiny lies in his name. All of that, and even the kind of traditional reading of this play about destiny, strikes me as uninteresting. So I don't teach it that way. But there are plenty of people who like are very mystical and they believe in stuff like the name and the feet, you know. My God, it's creeping in with Jesus on the cross, you know. Which, you know, far I know it is, but that's not the way I teach it, yeah.
Oedipus, at least in this translation, comes down and says, yeah, it was my destiny for all this to happen, but it was still my fault. It doesn't matter to him. And that's what we like about him. You know, you can say it was destiny, but he says, his view is, it was still his fault. That's why he punished himself. You may say, no, it's your destiny. Don't you see? Apollo is controlling it. He says, you know, for a lot of you guys, that might be okay, but not for me. I take responsibility for my actions. That's why it's so powerful. You may say, Oedipus, you're so wrong. Well, duh. You know? But he's not here to argue with it. Right? You want to say, Oedipus, you're so blind to the truth. And he goes, yeah, why do you think I put out my eyes? Huh? I could have killed myself. I could have thrown myself under a subway train. I could, right? But I did the eyes because I know what the problem is. I'm a kind of symbolic guy. Because it's the same problem you all have. You think you see the truth. When your eyes are open, you're blind to the truth. But when you put your eyes out, then you get it right. Okay? That's a really powerful image. Okay, so that's, careful, it's a very literary conception. You don't need to go putting our eyes out there to see the truth, all right? But it works very well in literature because it's something we can understand. Yeah.
So is he the only person with pierced ankles? Or?
Yes.
Why?
His dad didn't have the pierced ankles.
Okay. I didn't know if, like,
there wasn't a family
thing.
Was
his ankles pierced?
They did it when they threw him out on the mountain.
Oh, okay.
Like they were thrust him out to throw him out, but the guy who took him released the bond and then handed him off. Okay, so it was a sign that they tried to kill him, but that somebody saved him. Right? So we need to... let's look at line 14. All there. This is very complicated, so what is the stuff we have to remember? Well, the blindness theme, I think. See, here's Oedipus looking at these people who are suffering in Thebes, and he says, I am ready to help, I'll do anything. I would be blind to misery, not to pity my people kneeling at my feet. I'm
blind to, I would be, but I'm not blind to misery. I see so clearly. I'm so smart. I solve Sphinx riddles. I've already sent to Delphi. My eyes are wide open. Can't fool me. Well, you know, he should be an irony, right? It's not true. He thinks he's seeing everything, but in fact he is blind, right? So that blindness imagery is set up right away. And so we have an image train, not like the fires in the Agamemnon, okay? But not really similar. Okay. Well, Creon comes back in. The Sphinx is described in line 45. You want to mark that line? You freed us from the Sphinx. You came to Thebes and cut us loose from the bloody tribute we had paid that harsh, brutal singer. The Sphinx was supposed to sing. There's this translation used the word tribute. That's why I started talking about that. It's a kind of mythical representation of perhaps domination by another state. But we don't need to get into that. And the Sphinx misses at the bottom of the page. Now, Creon comes in. And if you go to line 80, you realize that the whole first 80 lines have been a setup, and that Oedipus has already taken action. He has sent Creon to the Delphi, to the Apollo's oracle, to get the answer to figure out why this plague is on Thebes. So that's line 80. I acted at once. I sent Creon to Delphi. Now, what makes this, then Creon comes in, and he reports that, according to the oracle, this is a line about line 110, the plague is punishment. The gods are punishing Thebes because they have not banished the murderer of their former king. He's in the city. There's a bad element here, and you got to get it out. Homeland security. Find it. Okay. Get rid of that element. Well, of course, you know, it's actually Oedipus. That's what they'll find out. But nobody knows that at this point. Right? And notice the way this oracle comes at line 110. Apollo commands us. He was quite clear, says Creon. Drive corruption from the land. Don't harbor it any longer past all cure. Don't nurse it in your soil. Root it out. It doesn't say specifically find the guy who killed Laius. It does more general. It's a sort of version of, remember, if you're going to give him a cryptic prediction of the future, do you remember what your cryptic prediction is? If you're an oracle, what are you going to say? Yoke the bulls and plow. There's a version of that. Don't harbor, drive corruption from the land, you know, yoke the bulls and, you know, just hide them and move it out of there. Well, it's not exactly that, but it's fairly ambiguous, okay? Line 113, banish the man, says Creon, or pay back blood with blood. This is pretty vague. Yeah, but this is how you're going to get rid of the plague. Line 122, pay the killers back, whoever was responsible. And at this point, Creon is sort of telling the story of Laius to Oedipus. Okay, line 118. Our leader, my lord, was once a man named Laius before you came and put us straight on course. I know, or so I've heard, but nobody had ever really thought about it or worried about his murderer. Okay, this is incredibly improbable. All right, but as Aristotle says, it's not impossible. Right. So we sort of, you know, overlooked this little creepy part of the plot. All right. Well, in comes the chorus. The whole play turns on, or Oedipus, look, and the clues start to mount to Oedipus that it's him. Because a guy named Tiresias is a blind prophet,
So naturally, you can see the truth. Comes in and says, you want the guy, Oedipus? It's you. And Oedipus says, I don't believe you. It's not me. I never did anything like that. And he gets, you know, he insists on pursuing the truth, even when the clues start to mount against him. But he gets angry, too. So, you know, maybe that's his flaw, that he gets angry. But that just seems to be irrelevant. Well, he's pretty sure it's not him, though, and that Tiresias is lying because there's this quibble, which first comes up here on this page, that the witness to the murder of Laius, remember here in focus, came back and said, a band of thieves set on the king and killed him. More than one person was involved in the murder. But of course, when Oedipus there, the actual thing, it was him alone. So the whole play becomes finding out. I mean, Oedipus' life is just balancing on a hair. If it was thieves, plural, he's innocent. But if it was thief, if the messenger was wrong, then he's realizes he's guilty. Okay. Iocasta says to him, are you out of your mind? I would just forget this whole thing. Okay? He says, no way. I always pursue the truth. And of course, what they do is they get the truth that he was the guy. But that's not the way it's what makes the play so brilliant, actually. Yeah.
Is he doing it for himself? Is he doing it for the play?
Yeah, both. I think he thinks he has to be exemplary for the people. And I think that's a good point. Social and private role. You know. That's why we admire him. That's his strong quality, isn't it? That's what makes this otherwise bullheaded stubbornness seem so admirable. Because he thinks he has to, that he's protecting the people. It never occurs to him that people can protect themselves, but that's fine. well, I don't know if I'm going to set this up in the next 5 minutes quite the way I want to, but so let's just go through, I haven't quite set it up. So let me just walk through a few more key lines here. I realize it's incredibly hard to read this stuff. And the word thieves is thieves, plural, is used at 138. And then two lines later, Oedipus uses the word thief at line 140. And this oscillation is kind of overlooked in the translation, but it's not reconciled right here, but it's set up already. Well, anyway, I think you can get through the first 165 lines, but then you hit the chorus. Now, when you're reading these Greek plays, the chorus drives you fast. Because they're talking metaphorically, they're moaning, oh, Laius, oh, you're... right? And you don't know what they're doing. The whole play stops while these people moan a lot, right? So let me just tell you, the first chorus here, which starts at about line 169, you can actually read it and put together what they're talking about. Right? And it's absolutely fascinating. They don't moan. In fact, they don't say, oh, Laius. They don't say, oh, my God, Oedipus, it is getting really weird here. You know? They go, I wish we didn't have to die. They start talking about death and immortality. They call on the gods to end death. Okay. And suddenly, and it seems disconnected to what's going on. But it's not. It's setting up the fact that this whole play isn't really, it is about ethics. It is about character and action. It's really destructive. But in the big picture, it's about the human condition based on the fact that you're always going to die and not live forever. And it's a kind of consolation for that fact.
Because as the end of the play says, you can be high and mighty and successful, just like Oedipus, but count no man happy till he's dead. Things can go really, really wrong at the end of your life, just like happened to Oedipus. You know, maybe immortality isn't the great thing, right? Because it just really gives you a lot of opportunity to screw up, which is probably going to happen to most people. But I'll end it there. I'm going to save the sorting out the shepherds and messengers for you. What should you do with Wedge? Yeah, read both Wedge. You know, we're doing the old movie. I'm not going fast, but if you haven't, I would try and get through this. We're going to put it all off the weekend while I get it. I'll finish this and do it at Antigone. Antigone is just as complicated. Actually, not as complicated.
February 22nd? Huh.